Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
I'm Bria Barthel. Tonight on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin by speaking with Agnes McCrae, who testified alongside others in support of the New York Caring Majority. Then we hear an update on protests against the Lafarge cement plant in Queens with Joe Ritchie and guest Christine Promomo. Later on, we look at actions of the Capital District Labor Action Federation to support passage of the federal Protecting the Right to Organize Act. After that, meteorologist Nick Johnston provides insight into this summer's local flooding and heat waves with tips on staying cool. Finally, we'll hear from activist Eugene O'Neill, not the dead playwright of the same name, about public art and activism. But first, here are the headlines.
Long-awaited regulations from Governor Cuomo for the $2.1 billion excluded workers fund will still excludes far too many workers from gaining access to the fund, according to advocates and lawmakers who fought for the funding. One new regulation is that workers must have lost half of their income in order to gain access to financial aid. This comes on top of the existing requirements that workers did not get paid more than $26,208 in the last year. This means that someone making as little as $20,000 over the past year could be ineligible for aid unless they were making $40,000 or more the year before and could prove it, which itself an often difficult challenge for low-income workers.
The state released a new application process for tenants and landlords seeking federal renting assistance one day after Senator Chuck Schumer slammed the Cuomo administration for slow-rolling payments to individuals at risk of eviction.
Two gun shootings in Albany on Monday raised the number of gunshot victims in Albany to 21 in the last 30 days. The city says reports of shots fired are up 22% over the past 4 weeks compared to the same period last year. Police departments across the state and county are reporting an increase in gun violence and homicides. The city's 10th and 11th homicides of 2021 on Friday led to the shutdown of Lark Street Bar Cafe Hollywood. The city said police have been called to the business 20 times in the past 3 months and claimed it had a connection to one of the recent killings.
The Times Union reports that after torrential rains 2 weeks ago, sediments from the Dewey Leffel Landfill Superfund site in the town of Nassau have poured into Little Thunder Brook and down into the Valachicil, raising worries about the spread of toxic wastes from the industrial dumping ground. An estimated 46,000 tons of industrial waste are buried there. The toxic materials include industrial solvents, waste oil, PCBs, scrap metals, sludge, and solids.
As the Attorney General's office appears to be wrapping up its investigation of numerous sexual harassment claims against Governor Cuomo, Cuomo has gone on the offensive, publicly questioning the independence of the lawyers hired to handle the investigation. However, many members of his own party have widely praised the lawyers leading the probe as apolitical and fair.
The city of Troy is seeking to settle a federal lawsuit filed by the family of Edson Thevenin, who was unarmed when he was fatally shot by the late Troy Police Sergeant Randall French in 2016, following a vehicle pursuit that ended with the officer ramming the suspect's vehicle into a barrier in violation of police policies. Several witnesses and even an internal affairs investigation that had been concealed by Troy City officials said that French was not in imminent danger when he fired the first two rounds through Thevenin's windshield.
The city mission in Schenectady has started a hydroponic farm in a 40-foot shipping container on Hamilton Street. The Gazette reports that since the freight farm became operational in February, they have grown more than 2,000 heads of lettuce that the city mission uses in meals, and its residence program participates in its dining center, which serves about 500 meals a day. Some of the produce is also given to guests.
The Rensselaer County USDA will be hosting a producer meeting for farmers on available USDA emergency programs on Thursday, July 22nd at 11 a.m. at Hoffe Harvest House, located at 489 Shear Road in Averill Park. The meeting is in response to the recent drenching rains that have harmed crops. And that's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Like what you hear, find these stories and more at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call us at 518-272-2390. Now for our first segment. Agnes McCray works for Arise in Syracuse, which is part of the Independent Living Center network across the state. She traveled to Albany recently to testify alongside others in support of the New York Caring Majority. Katie Carroll, a disabled woman from the Capital Region and volunteer with New York Caring Majority, interviewed Agnes about her journey to Albany and the importance of fair pay for home care.
The American Disabilities Act, ADA, turned 31 years old on Monday, and it is not just about non-discrimination in employment, curb cuts or ramps, accessible restrooms at your favorite restaurant, or lifts on buses. Home care for people who need services and supports at home is also part of the right to community integration. For people like Agnes McCray, it is essential, but her access to it is far from readily available. Katie Carroll spoke with Agnes, who testified alongside others in support of the New York Caring Majority.
My name is Katie. I am a disabled person living in the Capital Region. I'm at a hearing today at the New York State Capitol, and with me is Agnes McCray. Agnes, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hello, my name is Agnes McCray. I'm a human rights advocate. I live in Syracuse, New York, and I'm also the president of our Independent Living Center there.
Thanks. So you live in Syracuse, but you're in Albany today. Why are you in Albany?
Well, because I'm in Albany because of fair pay for home care and the right to choose my level of care at home. We're celebrating the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a civil rights law from 31 years ago. And it gives us all the right to choose and to be independent. And for me, home care is no exception, because what most people would like to believe, I am not a label. I am a person with a very successful life and a mother of three. And the civil rights law and part of the ADA gives me a right to be in charge of my own health. It empowers me to be a better person.
So, happy anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was just yesterday and is 31 years old. So this issue sounds not just of professional interest to you, but personal as well. Could you talk more about why you personally feel so strongly about your receiving services at home?
Well, I live in the Syracuse area, and there we have one of the largest contingency of the consumer personal care assistant, which is self-directed, where I get to hire my own staff, and I am the longest tenant in the program now. I've been there for 27 years. And it works for me. But now, since COVID, it's hard to maintain an aid when it's less than a minimum wage for the work that they have to constantly do. I recently Lost an aide that was with me for 14 years and put my needs ahead of herself and even her own daughter. The wages were so low, she couldn't even afford to repair her own car, and it snows a lot in Syracuse, which means that she had to walk a lot, 20 minutes to me and 20 minutes back. And if that doesn't show dedication, I don't know what does. But I'm here today also because we need fair pay for home care to have better options of support when it comes to our health. Nursing homes is definitely the only option on the table right now for most people who cannot afford to pay their aides, and they're ending up in nursing homes, or they have to pay their aides out of their own pocket, even if they're on a fixed income.
So I'm glad you mentioned the aide that can no longer work for you. When we think today about essential workers, many people think of those who work in hospitals, but there are so many that we don't actually get to see, like people like your aide who is helping you at home. I have two quick questions. One is, what do your attendants, what do they get paid, and why are their wages so low?
They get paid $12.50 an hour, and that is it. And it was that low because that was what the wages that were set for New Jersey, especially when it comes to attendance that are that a person chooses. The argument is that they're not licensed or trained, because really you can choose whoever you would like to have. And also another thing is that for persons who speak a different languages as well, there's also an issue because they also have family members that need care. And in Syracuse, we have a very large contingency of that as well.
So, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time with you left. It was really great to see you here in Albany. We're kind of all in this together, and we have to address this at the state level. So, people in the disability community like you and I, we know that this issue affects people of all ages, but so many people don't really think about it until they get older and they acquire disabilities and need home care. What message do you want people to know who are maybe not, they're not familiar, like they haven't had to think about this yet, or maybe are just on the verge of thinking about it?
Home care means a lot of different things. It means health, it means productivity, and it means keeping me out of a nursing home or care facility, which right now would be not cost effective to the state. If I was go into a nursing home, it's $18 versus $400 a day if I lived in a nursing home.
All right. Well, we have to let you go so that you can get home. You making this trip is really important to everyone who needs these services. And thank you.
That was Agnes McCrae being interviewed by Katie Carroll, who also wrote the introduction within the segment about the ADA. New York Caring Majority recently launched iCan'tFindHomeCare.com to help gather data on the extent of the home care workforce shortage. And the Fair Pay for Home Care Bill was introduced during the legislative session as bill number A6329.
Frequent listeners will be familiar with community concerns regarding health issues related to the Lafarge cement plant in Queemans and the Norlite plant in Cohoes. Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer and Norlite activist Joe Ritchie talks with Christine Promomo about the protests against the Lafarge plant.
Where do you live?
I live in Queemans, New York, Southern Albany County.
What do you do as your profession?
I'm a retired registered nurse.
How have you seen your profession impact the community that you're in now? And maybe even because of the times that we're now with COVID, how have you seen your profession make a positive impact on the lives of local residents?
Well, as a retired nurse, I am a member. I joined the Albany Medical Reserve Corps volunteer group from Albany County many years ago, actually. And we were asked and activated to help with the vaccinations and as well as contact tracing. So I, as a nurse myself, did that for folks in our community. We have had Albany County Sheriff's Office run several vax clinics in the town. And so from my perspective, that's been the primary way I, as a nurse, and the school nurses at the Ravenna Queeman Selkirk High School system have also been involved.
Great, thank you. And I always like to ask people that question because I think it gives a nice perspective of the positive contributions an individual citizen in the area can make. So I think that's awesome. So are there any environmental concerns in your area, in the city that you live in?
Yes, Joe, there is. We live in the shadow of the Lafarge Wholesome Cement Plant, which has been located and is located next to our high school and middle schools right across the road, also several miles from our elementary schools in the school district. And Lafarge Wholesome has a long history of environmental violations starting back over 10 years ago when they were spewing from their smokestacks when they were making their product cement into the atmosphere that contained very high levels of mercury. So as a result, $10 million in fines, they had to rebuild their stacks. However, that didn't stop them from continuing their quest to start to want to burn waste and tires in their cement kiln to fuel the production of their cement that would supplement the coal they currently burn, cost them less money, but of course, spew toxins and waste into the air that would spread everywhere, not just in our community.
What are some of the things that you guys have done in respect to, have you guys done protests against Lafarge? What are some of your guys' actions and maybe successes?
Well, our first big success that happened was back in the end of 2016-17 when Judith Enck, who we all know is our environmental guru here in the Capital Region and beyond, she heard through another environmentalist that Lafarge Wholesome was in conversations and talks with the state of Connecticut to begin to import waste and tires into their cement kiln to begin to burn those, that waste and tires. And that kicked off a press conference. Our town board that was currently running the town said, stop, this can't happen. We spent about a year working on a clean air law that would severely restrict burning of tires in our cement kiln there. And that was a big victory when that bill passed. At the same time, Albany County, we had a county legislator in our district who also said, we need to do this at the county level. So that took about a year and a half to pass a clean air law, a little less restrictive than we would have liked, but we had many people who showed up, who came to the public hearings, who spoke out, not just from our community, but beyond. That bill passed as well. Most recently, the end of 2019, we found out our town board that flipped at the last election. The incumbents now, who are all, they were all funded by big money, by Port of Queeman's company, by Lafarge Wholesome. They won their election. We have now 5 non-environmentalists and friends on this town board. As soon as they came into office, they decided to amend our clean air law in the town of Queeman's. And by doing the amendments with one hearing for public hearing during COVID, They voted on these amendments. It passed unanimously. But what these amendments did was strip out every single protection for tire and waste burning that was in that law. Because of a crazy regulation in New York State environmental law called Home Rule, no longer does our bill, our law, apply in our town, but also the Albany County bill no longer applies. So currently, if the DEC would want to renew a permit, which they did deny the permit, their old permit to burn tires, if they did renew their permit, you know, there is no protection anywhere in New York State to prevent them from starting this. We had protests. We tried for a permissive referendum in the town. Right around Christmas time, we got 254 people to sign a petition going to the town saying, we want to be able to vote on this amendment changes, and they threw out our petition. So that's where we are right now. Our Clean Air Coalition of Greater Ravenna Queemans has really ramped up its activities since then. We've been working with Lights Out Norlight, some of the other larger environmental groups around the communities. So that's where we are right now. We're still waiting and hoping that we're going to be able to influence legislation that will stop waste and tire burning within New York State and also hopefully anywhere in the country.
Yeah, no, I'm really impressed by all the accomplishments and the resiliency you guys have had to go through. When did you guys first hear about the Norlight struggle up in Cohoes?
I have to say it was through my my work with the Albany County League of Women Voters. We have a advocacy program committee, and that the Norlight issue came to the forefront from them, and then also through Judith Enck, of course, because our Clean Air Coalition is very plugged into her initiatives and activism as well when it comes to incineration, fossil fuels, and waste.
My next question is, do you think that the DEC is doing an adequate job to protect residents of New York State from these types of polluters?
I would have to say, on balance, until recently, no. No, they have not. And we have experienced that in our community, as well as I know you have with Norlight has been an issue. You know, we've had meetings with the DEC face-to-face asking for information about permitting process, beneficial use determinations, all of these things that are happening and going under the radar by the Lafarge Holcim plant, and it's not been an easy relationship. On the other side, I do understand that the DEC has been severely underfunded over the last several years. It is not the same organization that I think it was when it was first started. I really feel that the DEC does a great job with all the recreational pieces, which is kind of their green face. That's what everybody sees, you know, the fishing, the hunting, the hiking, the trails, but they don't understand the power that they have over these environmental issues, which are way more equally as important. I feel New York State needs a completely different environmental watchdog organization, not selected by the governor and any other of the big polluters in the state. They can't be involved any longer because they have their fingers in there.
So do you think that facilities like Lafarge and Norlight should be located in a residential area or by a school?
No. No. Would anyone? I mean, we do our activism down in our community, Joe, you know, we ask people, and it doesn't matter what their political affiliation is, who they voted for, who they believe in. When we went around door to door during COVID, by the way, to get signatures on our petition for the referendum in the dead of winter in a snowstorm, people had no idea this was happening, and they did not want to see our clean air law in our town stripped of the protections. People do not want to see waste and garbage and industrialization of our community.
My final question is, do you believe that Norlight and Lafarge should remain open?
Should they remain open? Norlight for sure needs to shut its doors, absolutely shut its doors. I would love to see Lafarge go as well, but I don't see that happening unless there's some kind of a revolution, because the Lafarge Holcim multinational corporate headquarters, you go on their website, you can look at their corporate documents and their public relations, they are absolutely focused on burning tires and waste to help reduce carbon as their green strategy when they're making cement. So we don't hold out much hope that that's going to happen where we are. But I believe absolutely Norite is a travesty and never should be shut down now. There's no need for that plant to be there. And then all those people that live at Saratoga sites, that's a polluted wasteland for God knows how long. Those people need to be relocated to new places that are going to meet their needs and be safe for everyone to breathe and go out and, you know, enjoy, you know, the parks, enjoy their backyard.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I think it was really valuable getting a perspective of our southern allies down in Queens and to talk about the northern allies up in Lights Out Norlight. So thank you so much for speaking with me today.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Joe Ritchie talking with Christine Promomo. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila Hickey.
And I'm Bria Barthel. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. We now turn to labor issues and hear the last part of Willie Terry's interview with Mark Emanation, director of the Capital District Area Labor Federation, about actions to push for passage of the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or PRO Act, and what that act would mean for working people. Let's join part three of their discussion.
And Mark, just a couple more questions. The AFL-CIO has something they call Worker First Agenda, and under here they have 5 points. So workers' empowerment, worker safety and the pandemic, good jobs and public investments, racial justice and democracy, and economic security. Now, are all those things included in that PRO Act?
So no. But the PRO Act will allow people to organize unions.
Just
And so, you know, you're absolutely right. All those things, but that's what the AFL-CIO, and that's what we need. But that's like other things too. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, I was on a call not that long ago where I made the point not as succinctly as this, but if you got every cop in the city of Troy to be like Mr. Rogers instead of the people that they've been up to this point, mm-hmm. still would have 50% of the people living in Troy in or near poverty, including a large percentage of African Americans and Latinos in poverty, but not just them, a large percentage of all sorts of people. So we need not just racial justice. We need racial justice, but we need that in order to really ensure that and get that, we need economic justice. We need to have a world where we can actually, you know, I mean, look at what's happening around the country right now with floods and fires and drought and heat waves and, you know, all of this stuff that's taken place. We need to have a society and a government that starts really working for working people and the needs that working people have, and to build a sane society where the world just doesn't, you know, fall apart. You and I go back, you know, known each other, but we go back a long way in this struggle and here and in other places. And when I was a kid, the big question was, what kind of world are we going to have? But now, you know, young people today look at, like, are we going to even have a world?
Right.
And so we need to change that and get workers in unions where they can. I believe wages, working conditions, and benefits are human rights, is a human rights issue. What we used to call bread and butter issues, I believe if you can't feed your family, and you can't clothe your family, and you can't take care of your family, and you go to work and it's unsafe, and you can lose your life, and all of those other things. I believe those are human rights issues. And I believe also the same thing is that if you don't feel safe in your neighborhood from the very people that are supposed to be supposed to be watching out for your safety, if you don't feel that safe in your neighborhood because cops are shooting at you because of the crime that you were born African American, and nothing else, not for anything that you did, but just because you were born black, and so cops can harass you and kill you, and you know, George Floyd you or whatever it is. We need a country that's not like that any longer. And I believe that the union movement has made big steps in this. The work that Terry Melvin is doing, all that kind of work, big, huge steps. That I'm proud to say I'm in a union movement where these steps are taking place. And you know, they've been a long time coming, my friend, but they're coming. Mm-hmm. And the union movement looks a lot more these days like you than like me. and that's a good thing.
Right.
That's a good thing. The president of when the Painters Union president got elected, National Painters Union president got elected to be president of the Painters Union, he introduced in his opening speech his father, who was kept out of the Painters Union because he was black. And that shows the change that's gone on in our country. And those changes were fought hard for the civil rights movement, and they reflect changes that are still, you know, taking place and influence people. And to me, those are really good things that's happened.
And Mark, this last question, too. I promise you that. One of the things is that, you know, the labor movement, we need community support, right?
Yep.
And what could the community do to support the union in their effort to get the PRO Act passed?
That's a great question, too. So I believe, you know, when we talk about that New York State has 2.5 million union members, right? So there's about 19 million people living in New York State, 2.5 million of them. So in my family, we got those union strong bumper magnets that are on our cars. Well, I have a son who's in a union. He's got it on his car. I'm in a union. I got it on my car. My wife's not in a union. She's got it on her car. My daughter's not in a union. She's got it on her car. My son-in-law's got it on her car. My other son has it on his car. So if we looked at our families and not just our members, and we looked at our families, there's a lot of people out there who support unions and what unions stand for. I'm not making this up when I say this. Without unions, I don't know where my family would be. I've worked union jobs and non-union jobs, and the union jobs have saved my tuchus. I wasn't born with a lot of money. I wasn't born with brains. I was born with, like everybody else, the ability to do some work and have somebody buy that work from me. And when I got hooked up with union jobs, it's made an enormous difference in my life. And so if we look at that, the people that benefit from unions, because they got family members in it, and we look at them as part of our union, if we looked at them as part of our unions, not like something separate, but really part of our union family, and we organized them, and we said, okay, we need everyone to make this phone call now, not just union members, we need everyone to make this phone call, and we went out and did that work, I think we would be a million times far off from better off than where we are right at this moment. I think we would be surprised at the power that we actually have if we organized those folks and treated them as like union sisters and brothers. And then folks that are besides that, that are just out there, when I say preach the gospel of unionism, most people don't know what unions do. Most people have been taught that unions are greedy, they only care for themselves, and they don't do anything else. I'll tell you one thing that I've learned in this time that we've been doing these food drives. And, you know, we've done, I don't know, we're close to 160 of them or more have been done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've worked with a whole bunch of people who never worked with a union before. And that's what they thought about us, that we were people that only cared about ourselves, maybe even didn't even care about our members. You know, the fat cat union bosses and all this kind of stuff. And they, a lot of them, you know, really believe that some of that propaganda, because what we don't go out and teach them another kind of, we don't go out and talk to them about the reality of what we're facing and what unions have done over the years that unions have existed in the United States. What real hard work has been done by those unions to make life better, not just for union members, but for everybody. And so I believe we need to go out and preach that gospel. And I say it like that because I think that's actually, you know, it's sort of a thing where it's something you can believe in, because it's very hard these days to believe in anything. And if you could believe that working people that do all the work and do every single thing in this country are smart enough and are organized enough to be able to go out and make life better for everybody, to build a new way of looking at things, to build a new society. If you went out and preached it along those lines where you're saying, we can make a better world if we all work together, I think you'd really have something.
Right. Okay. Okay, Mark, I want to thank you, and I want to say that I got a lot of information from you on the PRO Act, plus a lot of additional information, which was good. And, Mark, we got to continue this discussion. This is not going to be
anytime.
The last time. Right?
So you doing all this work, and I know that radio station doesn't reach a million people.
Nope.
But it does reach people. And by being shared on social media, it reaches more people. And, you know, that old saying is like, if you put the right things in it, people will find their way to it, and it'll make its way. And the station does good, but the work that you're doing and giving a voice to labor, there used to be on every newspaper around here a labor reporter. That doesn't exist any longer.
Right.
And so this is the only way we can get it out. And this is it's really important stuff. Okay, well, I appreciate that. And anytime you need me, just call me.
Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you again. That's Mark Emanation, Director of the Capital District Area Labor Federation. Thank you again, Mark.
Thanks, Lily.
That was part three of the interview between our roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry, and Mark Emanation. You can find the previous segments on our website at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
For our next segment, Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Sally Becker talked with local meteorologist Nick Johnston about recent local flooding and heat waves, as well as tips for staying cool.
I'm Sally Becker with the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and today I'm joined by meteorologist Nick Johnston. Thank you so much for joining me today, Nick.
My pleasure, Sally.
So how long have you been a meteorologist, and what's your background in the field look like?
Yeah, well, I graduated in 2004 from SUNY Brockport with a Bachelor of Science degree in meteorology. And after that, I went to the New School Center for Radio and Television here in Albany to get my broadcasting. First job in TV was in Wichita Falls, Texas, which is in North Texas, middle of nowhere. But I got to do some storm chasing there, so that was pretty exciting for me, tornado chasing and whatnot. Then I worked in Burlington, Vermont for about 4.5 years. And then I moved back here to Albany, where I worked first at News Channel 6 with Steve LaPointe, and then over at News Channel 10 with Caparizo.
And currently you're working independently, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I now work for the State Comptroller's Office in a training capacity, and I still do the weather. For the past 4 years, I've been doing the weather independently, just on Facebook Live, kind of as a hobby.
How do you, like, get that information for your forecasts on there?
Well, I use a lot of the same resources that I did when I was in TV, from the National Weather Service, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, several forecasting models I look at. And then from there, you know, kind of a, observe, my background in living locally and observing the weather.
My observations of the weather recently has been that this summer has been very rainy, more than usual, at least I think so. Is that like, from your standpoint, is there like a reason for all this rain, or is it just kind of something that happens?
Well, there are definitely reasons, but at the same time, it is sort of something that occasionally happens, yes. So there's been kind of a combination of both surface weather features like fronts, upper level features like troughs. We had the remains of tropical storm, I believe it was Elsa, come through, you know. And we've also had kind of a Bermuda high is what it's called, sometimes off the Atlantic coast, which kind of blocks some of these systems that would normally maybe only last one day, have ended up kind of stalling over the region and given us 2, 3, or 4 days worth of rain, where normally it might only have been one. So, but to answer your question, yeah, it's been kind of a combination of unfortunate events that definitely have made July very wet, very wet. Yeah. To that point, normally in July for the entire month, we'd get about 4.5 inches of rain. So far in Albany, we've gotten 7.71, not including whatever we end up getting today. And that would place us right now as the 6th wettest July on record. The wettest being back in 2009, where we got 9.91 inches of rain. And with, you know, still a week left in the month, there is a chance we could make it that. Hopefully not, but there is a chance we could make it to number one. Well, fingers crossed the weather will change. And the long-range forecast does not look as wet. So I have high hopes for August.
We've seen a lot of flooding globally and even locally in like Fonda and Rensselaer. Do you think that has to do with the changing climate and weather, or is it more of a problem, you think, with like sewers and drainage, or probably even a combination of the two?
Well, yeah, potentially a combination. Certainly as the climate warms, warmer temperatures allow the air to hold more moisture. So certainly in that capacity, the two could be linked, but it's hard to blame any one month or any one storm on climate change. But certainly, you know, as the climate warms, it can lead to things like that happening, certainly globally and locally. You know, Albany has reported 7.71 inches, but that's kind of a snapshot. That's only what's happened in Albany. As you mentioned, parts of Rensselaer County, Troy area, some of those areas have been absolutely slammed with flash flooding. And Rensselaer County, just so far, has received, at least parts of it, 13.66 inches. And parts of the Berkshires have received 13.45 inches. So, you know, Albany may have only got 7.71, but other parts of the region have seen nearly double that. That's important to remember, too. So, yeah, it's been a rough month. And I know I've talked to some farmers recently. Farmers need 3 days in a row of dry weather in order to cut hay. And they haven't had that. There's been only 3 days in the month of July that have not rained in Albany. To that point, yeah, for a farmer, this has been a really rough time because they haven't had even 2 days in a row of dry weather. So they have not been able to, you know, get the hay cut, things like that. So we're all hoping for a better month of August, certainly, because it's been a tough month for those who have the flash flooding, and then for those who maybe didn't have the flooding but just can't do their job. If it's taxing on humans, it's taxing on animals too. I don't know. My garden's been growing gangbusters, so I don't know. I can't keep up with the weeds. That's my problem. But I'm certain it definitely affects different crops and different plants differently. Thankfully, it has really only been July. And interestingly enough, you know, outside of July, the first 5 months of the year were dry. We were well below average when we came into July. Now we're about an inch above normal for the year. We played catch up and then some. Through June, it was a dry year, and then everything changed in July. So we'll see. Certainly everything can change again. You know, we might end the year dry. Definitely July has been one for the books. Yep.
When it hasn't been raining, it's been very warm out. Do you have any tips or advice for beating the summer heat?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, lots. I mean, your best bet is always cool water. So, you know, it's funny, as I've gotten older, I find I'm more sensitive to the heat than I used to be in my youth. You know, I remember as a kid, nothing bothered me. It didn't matter how hot it was. You know, I'd be running around outside playing. But as I'm remembering, you know, usually there was a sprinkler or, you know, some kind of water source involved. So that still works. Also, I remember taking road trips with my parents in a car that had no AC through the, you know, the Four Corners region. And what we would do is actually we'd stop at gas stations and just get like a washcloth. You'd buy a bag of ice, you'd fill the washcloth with ice, and you'd just put kind of an ice pack on your head. That's actually how we'd cool off. So that still works. And of course, a pool, great option. We've got a lot of beautiful lakes in the region. That's a great option. And then, of course, now I'm a huge fan of air conditioning. So, you know, when I was in Texas, I happened to get there just in time for their third hottest summer on record, which was unlucky for me because I'm not built for a normal Texas summer. And, you know, that was brutal. I remember there were days when I'd be heading to work and I'd have to use leather driving gloves just to touch the steering wheel because it was that hot. So I've felt worse than we get it, but yeah, there's definitely ways you can always cool off, and it's important to learn your body and learn the symptoms of when you're starting to overheat and know when to take a break and find a way to cool off.
Do you think we'll continue to see more summers like this with excessive rain and heat, or is this maybe just different summer?
Well, yeah, I mean, as the temperatures rise. Certainly the National Weather Service just recently released their updated temperatures. Every decade, they do a new average temperature for the Albany area based on the past 30 years. So in 2010, they updated it. And now as of the end of 2020, they've just updated it again. And the latest update showed that Albany rose by, I believe it was 0.8 degrees, which might not sound like a lot. And again, it doesn't usually manifest on any one day, but that's an average. So over the average of the entire year, we are seeing warmer temperatures. So to the extent that that trend continues, yes, we can probably expect warmer and wetter weather in general. Yes.
How can people find out more about you?
The easiest way to find me is on Facebook. That's meteorologist Nick Johnston.
That was Sally Becker giving us a report on what's going on with our weather. With Nick Johnston.
In our final segment, HMM producer Lizzie Kramer speaks with artist Eugene O'Neill about his mural in downtown Troy on the YWCA building, the role of public art in the Capital Region, and the importance of art in his personal life.
This is Lizzie Kramer. I'm here with artist Eugene O'Neill to discuss his latest mural on the YWCA in Troy and public art and its role in his life.
My name is Eugene O'Neill. I am a muralist, clothing designer, screen printing, embroidery, graphic design, educator. I love to teach youth through the lens of art, and anyone really. If I say that, that's too small of a box. I teach everyone through the lens of art. How to just be more authentic versions of themselves. If I were to like generalize all the things I do, it's really focused on that goal.
I'm curious how you found your way into the creative world here.
I was pretty artistic, I guess, naturally. Like I liked to draw or things like that as a kid, but it wasn't a focus. I was in like every sport. I ended up really loving teaching. I felt like a call to action, like I have to do this for them, help them be better than what we are. So it just felt like that all the time. And I've had students come back like way later, say that, you know, me teaching them art is a tool for expression, you know, another form of language to talk to yourself. In some regard, it saved some of their lives. The owner of Fourth Family, which they do sports sciences with kids, they teach them all the alternatives to jobs they can do without the basketball. So they go into inner city areas and then they help kids learn STEM programs and coding and all the other aspects of basketball. That one day he calls me, because I was doing their clothes for a long time, and then one day he calls me and he goes, yo, I got this idea for like a program. I want to paint murals with kids on the Red X buildings in Albany. What's crazy is 8 months prior to that, I said literally verbatim the same thing in a meeting with Tony Idesico. And I just couldn't help but feel like, oh, the message received. He had pieces of the puzzle that we didn't have. And that kind of changed everything, was that we got a chance to work with the Albany Land Bank, and we didn't have to work with the city anymore. The city made it so you couldn't do art. It took 6 months for them to like even get anything in motion. They wouldn't even respond for 2 months, and it was impossible. Like, the avenue, the access to arts was very limited 5 years ago. That was my first art program, like, reintegrating me back into, like, art education. So, like, it was youth around. It was the murals at Henry Johnson and Clinton, my first instance back into, like, curriculum development and, like, writing programs that would teach kids not only just how to mural, but also, like, giving them an opportunity to like learn the language, to explore themselves, and just be aware of like what it means to be engaged in your community.
And what do you think is the special part of murals?
Well, it goes back to that dynamic of the lack of arts here, how it became such a billboard representation of a message. Well, it's not here, so this is gonna get so noticed. It's gonna change the landscape. And it was just this idea that like we needed to bring a psychological change to communities in a way that like we're all exhausted, you know what I mean? Everyone is like, BIPOC individuals, extremely tired, supporting it for way longer than people have caught on in its trend and its recent media outbursts. You know, it's like everyone's tired, so how are we going to preserve our energy but still continue to speak so loudly? You can only do that with a mural. It stays in their face and it stays there with them, and then they get to have their own conversation with it, and we get to rest our voices a little bit and come back with another burst. So that's why murals. It was a modal to teach different metaphors of how you should show up for others and how you can also show up for yourself and how you can express yourself. And it fit the bill for a lot of things we were trying to bring together.
What kind of messages you try and communicate in sort of the murals you do?
I don't know. It's maybe not about any individual thing. It's about the fact that every little thing is an intentional piece. It's not just like aesthetically placed. It's aesthetically rendered, but it's intentionally placed. Even like the QR code that we put on the board, I don't think that's in the area enough. I was like, it's not really about me or glorifying like me making art and claiming spaces. It was like that alleyway was kind of scary. It reclaimed that whole space for them. It made people feel like they could access the whole range of the building. It makes people feel like, one, they want to be there, and two, like this makes me feel proud. And it was also, the main thing was like, okay, so it wasn't for me, it was for the women inside. Originally, when I came there and I started doing clothes initially for the YWCA, I was thinking about painting a mural inside the building, because we just wanted to like do something intentional and positive and empowering for the women inside, so it could, all of a sudden these calls for the grants were going around for the art center, and I'm stuck in curriculum development. Jade's like, yo, you have to apply for this. I know you're an amazing artist. They do not know. And that's what it is. It's almost like that's the art. What does this space actually need? Your ability to listen, know what's there, know the people enough to like give them some type of supporting element. And it was like, that's idea behind it, was that those two hands is naturally like the creation of Adam, women being the creator and the giver of life, and this nurturing hand, and just the nature of what I had learned during the pandemic. The people who really show up for me are these women, and so I'm gonna do what I can to show up for them. But then it was just this idea of like women supporting women, which is a divine power in itself. It's like this unspoken, tethered web that's like, someone's not okay, and women will come there and support that individual. And it's like, you don't really get that with men. Like, you get that in some men that are like conscious enough to see something happening, but to have people just like aware in such a socio-emotional way, it just was like, this is powerful and real, and it's happening all around me. If you don't see it, you don't see it, but you can feel it always. So it was to like, support that idea, and like what the YWCA shows up for those women and how they show up as an organization to support the other individuals who are amplifying their voices in the community. So it was like, whatever it is, it needs to support that message of women supporting women. and eliminating racism. So there was just this idea of that hand being such a culmination of different shades and tones, and it had the LGBTQ colors in it. This idea of, you know, this hand broken in pieces and kind of comes together separated, detached, but bright and vibrant, you know, almost like the short-circuited plug. Like, it just needs that power source of, like, uniformity, the box, this pillar that you can build upon. This idea of it being even in its approach to just incorporate anything it's connected to or integrate to anything it's connected to. So it was just this metaphysical hand that really played a part in saying, like, all are welcome here. How do we do that with color as a differentiating factor? If you like look at the bottom right hand of the mural, in the curve of the guardrail, I wrote truth, and that's my tag. My art tag is truth, and I tag that in everything I've ever made in art. In college, that's what started Made in Truth Clothing, which is my clothing business. I was writing truth, but it was like a game. It was like, where's Waldo? Like, people were always looking for truth. Like, that was like the first thing they ever tried to do when they look at my new artwork. It always just made them look at every single detail so intentionally. That kind of just became a precursor for how I just made anything. They were always searching for the truth in anything I was making. So it was ironic how it plays a part in me being like, nah, this is why I did all these things. And most importantly, the whole reason the QR code is there is so you donate to that building. How do I make people know what this is too? And how do they give you money? So that was my first MO. But then also an intrinsic motivator and piece of like internal conversation with the residents who live there. So it worked in both those ways. It was like, how do I communicate to these people who have no idea what this building is? And then how does this communicate to what people inside may be feeling?
Is making more solo murals something that's high on your agenda?
It's tough right now. I'm in this space where, like, I'm only so many things.
Is there anything else you want to share?
I think that as long as people continue to value art that it's not, it's so accessible, but we perceive it to not be accessible. It really does bring people together in a way that art is not linear in the sense that it's a painting or a sculpture or a mural sometimes, or music even. There's an art in conversation, there's an art in business, there's an art in being able to support others or heal others, or it plays a part in so many different things that if we did look at it all like art, it would integrate us so much more. There'd be a lot more compassion for each other, and there'd be a lot more mindfulness and sensitivity to the fact we're all just trying to do what's best for us, and some are trying to do what's best for others. Some are trying to do what's most for others more. And where do you fall on that spectrum? How do we give as much as we receive? What is that balance? And like, we find it through these avenues of art, but it's very latent in our everyday practices. But I think art teaches it in such an abstract way that it really is a cultivation of like practices of humanity. Close ourselves off from it, even when you don't have the time or it feels like you're not in the mood, or not to force anyone to do anything, but it's if we want to continue moving in any direction other than the one we feel stuck in, it's essential.
That was another art segment from Lizzie Kramer. And in this segment, she spoke with artist Eugene O'Neill. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey, also your engineer.
And I'm Bria Barthel. Thanks to all my fellow volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org/stories, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.